Note to listeners, this episode originally aired a few years ago. The defendant in this case was convicted and sentenced to 30 plus years in prison. Since that time, he has appealed his conviction, and the Court of Appeals has granted him his appeal and overturned his conviction. He's been granted a new trial in the original trial court. He is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Thank you.
Deceit is everywhere in Linda Ladd's chilling new psychological thriller, Witness Betrayed, a Will Novak novel.
One moment, private detective Will Novak sees a woman staring at him. The next, she's gone. When she shows up again, it's with a gun to his head and a story about crony politics, a kidnapped whistleblower, and children in deadly danger.
Take a suspenseful journey through the gritty underbellies of Houston and Beverly Hills in Witness Betrayed. Now available everywhere ebooks are sold.
That's right. For more information, visit kensingtonbooks.com. We love those guys.
Please be warned that the details of this case are graphic and may be difficult to hear. It is not an episode for young listeners.
So she tells me, and she tells the sexual assault nurse, she went to the door to see what you were doing and that you let her in to the room with you and then locked the door behind her. That it was you that pulled her pants off and that you pulled your pants down.
I don't remember it that way, but I'd suppose it's possible.
Do you ever look at child porn?
Most of what I do, even as far as eroticism type stuff is concerned, is actually written stuff that I read, not videos.
What's the subject matter of those writings? Child stuff?
No. Occasionally a couple of child things do sneak in. I usually look up things related to incest.
I'm Yardley.
And I'm Zibby. And we're fascinated by true crime.
So we invited our friends, Detectives Dan and Dave,
to sit down with us and share their most interesting cases.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Dave.
We're identical twins,
and we're detectives in small-town USA.
Dave investigates sex crimes and child abuse.
Dan investigates violent crimes. And together, we've worked on hundreds of cases, including assaults, robberies, murders, burglaries, sex abuse, and child abuse.
Names, places, and certain details, including relationships, have been altered to protect the privacy of the victims and their families. While we realize that some of our listeners may be familiar with these cases, we hope you'll join us in continuing to protect the true identities of those involved out of respect for what they've been through. Thank you.
Today on Small Town Dicks, we have the usual suspects. We have Detective Dan.
Glad to be here.
And Detective Dave.
Good to be here.
So Dave, tell us how this case came to you.
So it's a weekend morning. I get a call from Sergeant Dave. He lets me know that patrol had been called out to an address in the west side of our town. And Sergeant Dave does what he usually does, our typical exchange. Hey, what are you doing? And I said, I'm thinking I'm going to work. And he gives me a brief rundown on what I'm going to encounter when I get to this address. The basic gist is this 9-year-old girl, her name's Katie. She was home with her little brother and their babysitter. His name's Lester. Lester is her cousin. He's in his 30s. And the parents had basically come home and caught Lester and Katie in a pretty compromising situation in the master bedroom.
Oh, God.
So I respond to the address. When I get there, Lester's seated across the street from this house. He's just sitting in the grass. He's talking with a police officer who's standing nearby. He's not in handcuffs. He's just kind of lounging in the grass. I go across the street and talk to another officer who had arrived on scene, and he gives me a little rundown on what had transpired, precipitating the need for the police to respond to the address.
Had the police brought him out of the house, and that's why he's sitting on the grass?
I later learn as I'm talking to the officers on scene that as they arrive, they see Lester walk out of the house and he's standing on the front porch.
Oh, and who called the police?
It was Katie's father, Joseph. So this 911 call is odd. What our patrol officers had encountered was Dad, Joseph, standing outside on the phone right about as they're pulling up and getting out of their car. Lester's walking out of the house. That's all they see is Dad and Lester.
So when you say that 911 call was odd and that it was placed from the front yard, is that because the dad was making that call quietly and didn't want Lester to hear?
Lester knew, based on Dad's reaction to what he encountered in this master bedroom, that the police were getting called. But he's hanging out inside, and the dad, I think, to separate himself from the situation so he didn't do something drastic. He's out in the front yard.
I see.
And he's understandably upset, and he's asking for the police, get here right now.
But he left Lester in the house.
With Katie, yes.
Oh, dear.
Okay. So you arrive, Lester's on the lawn sitting rather casually. That seems so strange to me.
Yeah, and I remember turning the corner, and this house is maybe on the corner or maybe one lot in east of this intersection you turn onto this street from. I look to the south, and he's just kind of leaning back, two arms bracing him up. He's got his legs kind of kicked out like he'd be hanging out on a beach.
That's weird.
Yeah, but I notice right away he's not in handcuffs and seems to just be relaxing. Got a police officer standing over him. So I talked to the primary officer on that case, who's now a detective with us, but he was a patrol officer at the time, and said, hey, what's up? And he walks me through what had transpired right before the police get called and then what happens once he arrives on scene.
Tell us about that.
Like I said, as our officers pull up to the address, they see Katie's father, Joseph, out on the front lawn. He's on the phone with 911, and Lester is coming out of the house as they're getting out of their cars.
Right. Yeesh.
The mom is inside the house dealing with her kids. Mom is Valerie. She's dealing with Katie and Katie's younger brother. He's maybe 4 or 5. And Dad starts telling the police what happened. Dad tells them that Lester is his cousin. Lester's got a past that involves sexually abusing a family member.
Oh.
And I won't say what the relation was because it kind of gives away maybe too many details about this case, but he had molested a family member back in his juvenile years and got in trouble for that, but received treatment, counseling, and had, according to the family, always been a little bit creepy, but he seemingly was normal and treated and rehabilitated. I have my own opinion on sex offenders and their ability to be rehabilitated, but Lester was entrusted with watching Katie and her younger brother while the parents, Joseph and Valerie, went on a weekend getaway for 2 or 3 days.
Why?
That seems so risky.
Right. In hindsight's 20/20. I get that. It was risky. And Lester had babysat on previous occasions. The family had seen how he interacted with Katie and her younger brother, and no red flags were going up for Joseph and Valerie, so they thought, we can get away for 2 or 3 days. I think they were going camping or something, and we'll leave Lester with the kids, and we got nothing to worry about. We can get a little break. So they get maybe a half an hour out of town and realize that they've forgotten something, and it turned out to be something that was truly inconsequential and you could pick up at any convenience store. It's a bottle opener.
Oh.
And they turn around and say, we'll just go back to the house and pick up our bottle opener or can opener, something like that. So the mom, she just stays in the car thinking this is going to be a dad runs in, grabs it, comes back out. Hey, toodles, we're out of here. And Dad goes inside, sees his son is playing on the PlayStation in the living room, says, hey, where's your sister? And the kid just points to the master bedroom. Where's Lester? Points to the same room. And the dad is starting to get the, holy shit, what the hell's going on? Why would they be in the master bedroom alone?
And the door's closed, I assume?
The door's closed. Joseph approaches the door, tries the door handle. It's locked.
Oh, God.
He's starting to get a little amped up. So Joseph kicks in the door, and what he encounters is his daughter is on all fours. She's got her pants down. She's facing this computer monitor, which is showing a not a pornographic video, but it turns out to be an informative video that's available on YouTube called something to the effect of a guide to sex in the 21st century or something like that. And it shows different positions.
Oh my God.
And the position that is on the TV at the time is anal sex, where a female is on all fours in front of the male. And so when this dad opens the door, that's what he sees.
No.
It's his daughter facing this video screen. She's on all fours. And Lester has his penis pressed up against her anus.
No, no.
And she's 9.
She's 9. He's in his early 30s.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
So they talk about freeze, flight, fight, those types of reactions. The dad does the flight. He goes, something to the effect of, oh, hell no, or fuck no, and goes straight out to the front yard and calls 911.
But Lester's still in there.
Lester's in the room, and Lester's doing the awkward, how's this going to go?
Oh my God. I have to remind myself that we all respond differently to shocking, traumatic moments, and that one person's reaction will differ from another person's, and it may not seem logical.
Right. The dad is handling this as best he can. He's dealing with a lot, and he's just trying to get through it, and he's step by step at that point. He wants to get the police there and wants to make sure he doesn't do anything that might impact his own freedom moving forward in his life, like beating this guy unconscious or something worse. So our guys, they get that 911 call that gets dispatched pretty quickly, because you can imagine a situation with those types of details could devolve pretty quickly.
That could devolve very quickly into a murder if that were happening in my house.
Yeah. So I remember when I had first spoke to Sergeant Dave, he said, when you get there and you figure out what's going on, give me a call. And so I stepped out to the street and called Sergeant Dave and said, hey, this is what we got. And he said, there's no murder. Nobody's dead.
Really?
Everybody I've talked to in law enforcement and beyond has all said, so wait a minute, the guy didn't kill him.
Wow.
Right.
They didn't even get in a scuffle.
No, there's no assault whatsoever between the two males. So now we got to figure out what type of contact has occurred before it gets interrupted.
And why is that important? Is it not enough that the dad walks in and catches this man about to sexually assault his 9-year-old daughter?
So there's a huge difference in those charges, an attempt or a completed act.
I see.
And also probably how long it's been going on, because he's babysat prior.
Right. And so we've got all kinds of things we got to figure out. So my first step was understanding from the parents what type of access this guy has to Katie. How often does he babysit? What's their relationship? Has she ever given off any signs that something like this has happened before? Don't get a whole lot out of the parents other than, yeah, he babysits. Not a lot, but a couple times a month, he'll watch her for a few hours or maybe overnight. And I talked to Katie, just a real brief field interview, and I don't get a whole lot from her.
What's her demeanor?
She's, when we talk about victims and they talk when they're ready to talk, this is kind of one of those bad situations for as far as circumstances surrounding a disclosure is. She's not ready to talk potentially. She's kind of forced to because everyone discovers this. It's an accidental disclosure. It wasn't prompted by her. It's prompted by her father walking in on something bad happening.
So when he walks in on her, she's not crying watching this video.
She's not protesting.
Not at all. She's actually pretty calm, a little bit defiant when I talk to her. She's kind of got her arms crossed looking at me like, why is this knuckle-dragging cop wanting to talk to me?
Really?
Real quick interview, 4 or 5 minutes. Ask her, hey, any idea why the police are out here? And she's like, it's because of what Lester did. Well, what did Lester do? She doesn't want to talk about it. So I'm not going to press her on that. But I'm thinking, we've got potential for skin-on-skin contact. I want this girl examined at the hospital so I can get some evidence. So we send her with her parents down to the hospital to get a rape examination by a sexual assault nurse. And they take swabs of different areas of her body. A lot of that is based on what her disclosure is or what we know at the time. So I relay to this sexual assault nurse. Her name's Donna. I've worked with her on tons of cases. She's really thorough and really experienced. And I let her know kind of what we're dealing with and what dad walked in on. So she takes swabs of this girl's genital region, her anus, vaginal swabs, those types of areas, just to see, who knows, maybe we got something. And all that stuff gets sent away to the lab, and I don't see it for months.
Wow.
It takes a long time to get that stuff back from the lab.
That always shocks me, by the way.
And so what do you do with the guy in between? Can you charge him and hold him?
Yeah, I'm sitting there going, okay, I don't have a disclosure from her about touching or what body parts were touched, but I can make some assumptions. But I also know there's times where you look at a situation, you go, I don't know what crime that is, but I'm sure you can't do it. Let me look in my trusty little Bible and figure out what laws he's broken. So I know I've got something, but I need to figure out exactly what. And a lot of that's going to depend on my conversation with Lester.
I see.
So we ask Lester, hey, do you mind coming down to the police station? In my mind, I'm thinking he's going to be under arrest for something, but we give him the option. Will you voluntarily take a ride down to the police station? He says yes.
Is he in handcuffs at this point?
When he gets transported, he was in handcuffs, but not until moments before he gets placed in the back seat. So he comes down to the police station in a patrol car. I drive separate, and we meet in one of the interview rooms that you guys saw yesterday.
Yeah, we got a tour. I have a quick question. When you encounter him on the site, you know, when he's leaning back on the grass, and then you ask him, would he be willing to come down to the station? Is he still pretty casual with sort of a blasé affectation, or is he defiant or defensive? Or did he seem sorry or remorseful or anything?
No, not really. He talks to our patrol officer before getting transported down to the police station, and he makes some statements about, hey, I fully expect that I'll be in jail for a few months. And I know that these are really bad circumstances. Things look bad, and I know I screwed up today. General stuff, but certainly if given in context and totality of the circumstances, someone would say he's making some admissions there. He's just not being very specific about it. So get him down to the station. We start the interview, and that begins the longest interview that I've ever conducted. And it's long because this guy has what's pretty typical in our business. He has some memory issues. I don't remember that.
Oh.
He's one of those guys. I don't remember that. And he would take long pauses in between. He's very calculating. You can kind of see the wheels turning when you're staring at him, asking him a question and what his responses would be. Throughout the course of that interview, we kind of slowly stepped through what occurred that day and what had occurred on previous occasions.
How much of what she said differs from what I've said? If anything.
Well, that's what the follow-up stuff I wanted to talk to you about.
Okay.
So she tells me, and she tells the sexual assault nurse, that it was you that pulled her pants off and that you pulled your pants down. Did you pull her pants off? Let me walk you through what...
Well, no. I'm trying to... I don't remember it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, as I said before, like, I don't remember. I'm honestly, like, trying to fill in the blanks, too.
And trying to block certain things out, you said?
Most likely. I mean, I don't think I'd have so many blanks if I wasn't.
Okay. Are you under the influence of anything today?
No.
Just a lack of sleep?
Lack of sleep, and I'm on SSI for having really bad ADD, ADHD. I don't remember.
Do you take medications?
No.
Okay.
I don't have very good short-term memory anyway.
So you have a diagnosis with those?
Yeah.
Okay. Do they prescribe you meds and you just don't take them?
No.
Okay.
I don't remember it that way, but I'd suppose it's possible that I might have helped her take them off, like after she like unbuttoned them or took a belt off or something. I might have helped finish removing them or something, but that's not the way I remember it.
Here's what she told me, and this is in a, albeit 3 to 4 minute interview with her, it's quick. She says that she's out in the living area of the house, and you're in the bedroom already, and that she went to the door to see what you were doing, and that you let her in to the room with you, and then locked the door behind her. Is any of that true?
Are you allowed to go off the record?
What do you mean? I mean, we're still recording here. What do you want to tell me? Why do you want to go off the record now?
Because I'm torn on how to answer that question.
Okay. Well, we can come back to it. All right. Here's the...
Okay. Honestly, I don't care how it looks for me. My thing is whether she's telling the truth or she's not.
Mm-hmm.
If and when push comes to shove in front of a judge, I will not contradict anything that she said, regardless of whether
she's lying. So you lie to protect her version of events?
Yes.
If you're addicted to true crime like we are, you need to check out the Weather Channel's newest TV series, Storm of Suspicion, which airs Sunday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Central. Storm of Suspicion has everything you love from your favorite true crime shows and documentaries, deceit, murder mystery, piecing together clues, but with a clever twist of weather in a way only the Weather Channel can do. Did a hurricane initially cover up and then help solve a murder? Did a rain puddle lead to a murder conviction?
Watch to see how weather can help suspects stay under the radar and also lead to their downfall. Dr. Elizabeth Austin, a world-renowned forensic meteorologist, will have you looking at crimes in a whole new way as she shows you how investigators can use Mother Nature to solve some of the most difficult cases.
One of the things that I really loved about the episode we got to preview, Kitty, is all of the footage of this extreme weather. It's just so harrowing, and it really ups the stakes in these cases.
Storm of Suspicion is unlike anything you've ever seen on the Weather Channel, so don't miss out, you guys. Watch Storm of Suspicion every Sunday night through November at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, only on the Weather Channel.
That's Storm of Suspicion every Sunday night at 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central on the Weather Channel.
Hey, small town fam. As your family is getting back into the swing of school schedules, let HelloFresh take the guesswork out of meals week after week.
With three plans to choose from, classic, veggie, and family, HelloFresh's meal kits make dinner easy peasy, even amidst the after-school chaos. No more having to plan, spend money on takeout, or worry about gathering ingredients week after week, because really, who has the time for that?
The easy-to-follow recipes and pre-measured ingredients are all delivered right to your door in recyclable, insulated packaging, which comes in handy on those hectic school nights when your to-do list is a mile long or you're busy chauffeuring the kids to practices and study groups. There's even a one-pot recipe for maximum flavor with minimal cleanup, so you can get more time back to do more of what you love.
I have to say, Kitty, I'm already a good cook, but one of the things that HelloFresh has reacquainted me with is the agility of a shallot.
The agility of a shallot. For a total of $60 off, that's $20 off your first three boxes, visit HelloFresh.com/smalltown60 and enter the code smalltown60.
It's like receiving six meals for free when you go to HelloFresh.com/smalltown60 and enter the code, here it is, smalltown60. Ask you a question. Do you consider those long pauses to be emblematic of a sociopath? Because you say he's calculating, so it seems deliberate.
And it certainly came across as deliberate to me. It seems like this guy's trying to navigate this interview with me and think really hard about what he's about to say with each answer. That's how I take that. And you've heard that before, either by Detective Don or Lieutenant Scott, about bridging and pausing, taking time. Sometimes they'll ask the question over. So why did I do what I did? They're buying time. Dan's dealt with it in his interviews too. These guys sometimes think they're the brightest one in the room, but the detective usually likes to be four or five questions ahead. And I certainly felt like I had the upper hand intellectually with this guy in the room, but he's really calculated.
I think this is a situation where he has to say something. You can't just be quiet. He's caught in a really bad spot. He has to explain something.
He never asked for a lawyer.
Never. We do the dance, the lawyer dance, but it's over one certain topic of that interview. So the majority of what I want to get to is what the actual physical interaction is with Katie.
Right.
And so, hey, walk me through what happened this morning. And he confirms a lot of the details. You know, I was just going to babysit Katie and her little brother. Parents left. They came back a little bit later, and I didn't expect them to come home, but they did. And I said, where were you? Well, we were in the master bedroom. How'd you get there? And he tells me that Katie is the one who prompted him to come into the room, that Katie's the one who's asking him to teach her about, quote, positions.
like I said, I know for a fact that I didn't go in that room until after she was already sitting down and she had that thing on there.
So for her to say that you were already in there and you led her into the room and then locked the door behind her is not a fact.
That is definitely not a fact.
Oh my God.
I hate him. What a pig.
You have to keep your poker face on because, of course, when I hear that, my first inclination is, you're full of shit, dude.
Victim blaming, how dare you?
There's no way this 9-year-old is saying, hey, teach me about sex, cousin.
Even if so.
You don't say yes.
Right.
Ugh.
You'd say, well, I'll let you go through school and you can figure that out.
Or you call her parents and say, she's asking some really racy questions that I think I need to leave to you, but I also want to alert you to the fact that she's 9 and she's very curious about things like anal sex. Like, you don't go, oh, okay, I should teach you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mad, sorry.
No, it's understandable. This is why I say it tested my patience. So he's victim blaming. He's putting the onus on Katie. But at the same time, he says, I'm in my 30s. I should know better. I should have never been in that situation. He also offers up that he's thankful that the dad came home when he did because things could have gone a lot further.
Wow.
And I'm sitting there thinking, this guy's an absolute pig. I wish interviews sometimes were scratch and sniff, where you could scratch the screen and you could smell how this room smelled. This guy is disgusting.
Ew.
Really? He was stinky?
Oh, horrible.
Like just bad hygiene?
Body odor?
Body odor, bad hygiene. He's one of those people that saves his cigarette butts and just puts them in his pocket. So he had like 30 or 40 of them.
What? What is the point of that?
So they can smoke them later.
Gross.
Ugh. Was Lester a heavy drug user as well?
I didn't get any indication that he's interested in meth. Marijuana, certainly. We later did a search warrant at his house and came across marijuana pipes. But this guy isn't driven by substance abuse or anything like that. He's driven by a different primary goal, which was to offend on little girls.
How does he explain the video they were watching?
Well, he starts talking about, yeah, she led me into the room. She had already queued up this video and put it to the point of the video that she was interested and she was wondering out loud to him, I wonder how this feels.
Oh, shut up.
And so he says that he's going to show her.
While you're hearing him say, she asked me to go to the back room, she asked me to look at this, she asked me to teach her, was there any part of you that felt like you needed to consider that as a possibility and that maybe that would be a tip off to the fact that she had been exposed to that kind of sexual behavior by someone else?
Right. So that consideration was made and he actually offers up that it was possibly her grandfather that had had this kind of contact with her before. And he also talks about some other situations on previous occasions that he'd babysat her, where one was he's using the bathroom and he's got an erection while he's urinating and she walks into the bathroom and it's an accident, but she's curious. And he talks about another situation where they would roughhouse. Katie and her little brother would roughhouse with him, and one time his hand accidentally went to her crotch.
Really?
Right. And this is that typical grooming stuff that we deal with, is testing the waters with physical touch, testing the waters with situations where you accidentally walk into the bathroom while the little girl is taking a shower or something like that. You're gauging reaction and desensitizing. So he talks about some of these grooming activities. He talks about giving her a piggyback ride. And while he's trying to hoist her up to his body, he puts his hands behind his back, kind of in a little tenting formation where his hands go right to her crotch. And I said, is there a component where this is a conscious decision? And he's kind of giving me, well, maybe.
Oh, Lord.
Like I said, that was an accident that happened once. Although now I'm starting to wonder why.
Why you would do that? I have an idea. I think you have an anal fetish. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah, no, that's not what I was talking about. No. No, I was starting to... I never thought I did, but maybe I do have some kind of attraction or something.
To her? I think you do. I mean, it's fairly obvious. I mean, you're actually...
I've never let it click together. I mean, it's been...
I think there's some things that you're trying to hope aren't true, but facts and evidence seem to point that you maybe have a sexual attraction at least to this girl.
Yeah, I think...
You've had multiple sexual encounters.
It sounds very much like he's trying to minimize his culpability by feigning some kind of in-the-moment discovery that, oh, wow, maybe I am attracted to her. I never thought of that.
It's disgusting, and I don't buy it. Plus, Joseph saw him in a sexual position with Katie. How does Lester attempt to minimize that?
Yeah.
Right. So he says he basically got interrupted. He was about to.
Can you charge him for sexual abuse even if he was just about to?
In our state, is penetration, however slight. That comes with the rape charge or an unlawful sexual penetration type charge. But with a sodomy charge, all I have to do is have contact. I don't have to have penetration. So we go over that and I set him up. Hey, she's at the hospital right now getting swabbed. Are those swabs going to pick up any of your seminal fluid on the vaginal swabs? No. I mean, my penis might have touched her vagina or her labia on the way up to her anus, but no, I just pressed it against her anus. And I'm thinking.
Yahtzee.
Yeah. And he says it over and over again.
And you have it recorded.
We've got it recorded. And he's saying, no, I wasn't trying to do anything. Wasn't trying to insert my penis into her vagina. I was just pressing it against her anus over and over again. He says that. And that turns out to be a factor in the trial and the jury's decision, is that he hammers that home. So knowing the type of guy I'm dealing with, I start asking him questions about computers. He's got a tablet in his backpack that came down to the police station with him. And I'm thinking this guy is a prime candidate for child pornography. He's going to have something on his computer. And he gets really hinked up about any questions about electronic devices, where he starts saying, if you're going to keep going down that path, then I'm going to want an attorney for this conversation. So that's where I talk about the dances. Why are you saying you want an attorney?
Even though I've said I can't live without my computer, so I don't want to just outright give you permission to take them, I feel that the reason why you're continuing to ask those questions is because you want more specific details to get a specific warrant to do so anyway.
Okay.
You're
a bright man.
And, I mean, we can continue along that line of questioning if we want to, but that's where I would enact my right to a lawyer.
Okay. Is that what you're doing right now?
No, I'm just saying, if you want to go down that line of questioning, we can, but that line of questioning will be with the lawyer present.
Okay.
I know technically I probably should have had a lawyer here from the get-go, but honestly, I don't give a crap about my own incarceration. Okay. I just want whatever's
so
best for
her. We're starting to talk about areas that I need to clarify and make some clarifying statements, okay? Is that you mentioned the lawyer and attorney a couple times here in the last minute or so.
I have not asked for a lawyer at this time.
So you're only if we travel down that road.
Correct.
Okay. So you're still willing to talk to me without an attorney present?
Yes.
If we're not talking about that situation?
Yes.
Okay. And so right now, you don't feel like I'm violating your rights by talking to you? You just don't want to travel down that road?
Correct.
Okay.
He's one of those guys. He thinks he knows the system, and it's because he's already been through the system with this other family member when he was a juvenile.
Now, if you are convicted of a sexual assault as a juvenile, are you a registered sex offender for the rest of your life, or is that expunged once you turn 18?
It depends. Sometimes you are, sometimes you aren't.
It depends on state or on the charges.
Could depend on the state. It could depend on the type of charge. It could depend on the type of deal that you took.
Oh.
So in this case, this guy wasn't a registered sex offender. The stuff from this other state that he lived in didn't follow him to our state. So it's just in his past, but it's not a big red flag.
Meanwhile, are you getting updated from the hospital about Katie's medical exam?
Yes. During this interview, I'm thinking, I wonder what's happening at the hospital and if she's talking to the nurse. So I take a break from the interview and I talk to the sexual assault nurse and say, hey, what's she saying? And she says, well, she confirms what you had already told me, but she's also saying that she felt something pressed against her anus, but she thought it was his hand or his finger. And so now I'm like, perfect. I've got touching. That's at least sex abuse. And if it's his penis, then I've got sodomy. In our state, that's a huge, huge sentence.
So he's caught quite literally with his pants down. He even admits he's sexually abusing her. What more do you need?
Yeah, but we've learned that, in fact, the more offenses you can pin him for, the longer he goes away for, right?
Correct. The penalty for contact with his penis and her anus, or his penis and her vagina, would be substantially larger than him just putting his hand on her vagina. Penetrative-type sexual abuse carries triple the penalty.
Wow. So Katie isn't really ready to divulge much to you, so where else do you go to find out how much and how often Lester has been sexually abusing?
I start really focusing on this computer, and case law is an ever-changing world for us. And for me to get into certain areas of computers, I have to check boxes that he's got videos, that he's got pictures, that he's got writings. So when I revisit the computers, I'm trying to get into more of his stuff.
So your search warrant can be more specific.
Right. So I can get a more broad search, more than you can look into his picture gallery, but you can't look at his email. So it's me kind of mining him for, give me more that I can get into your computer. And he gives it to me. He starts talking about writings and short stories and comic book type anime type child porn, which we see coupled together all the time in my world. Child porn, they'll have anime, which is animated cartoons and comic book strips of children being sexually abused. And then they'll have writings about describing adults having sexual experiences with children.
Ugh.
So I'm trying to get into all of that. And eventually he gives that to me. So I write a search warrant for his house. And Sergeant Dave comes in and assists me. I have to go out that night to a judge's house, get it signed, and we go hit his house.
What's his living situation like?
Well, he lives with a family member. And they're like, well, what are you doing here? I said, well, he's down at the police station and this is what he did. And they said, it's a matter of time.
Yikes.
Really?
Right. So these are family members that are familiar with his oddness. And I had asked Lester while I'm gearing up to write this search warrant.
Do you ever look at child porn?
I've come across it, but I've never actively tried to view it.
Where have you come across it? Like a website that pops up or something?
Well, I just assume it's... there's certain websites, like I'll look up certain things. It's not very often, but on a couple of different occasions, there's been pictures that I can only assume were younger than 18. As far as I know, there's nothing related to child porn whatsoever on any of my computers.
Okay.
Most of what I do, even as far as eroticism type stuff is concerned, mm-hmm. is actually written stuff that I read, not videos.
Okay.
What's
the subject matter of those writings? Child stuff?
No. Occasionally, a couple of child things do sneak in. I usually look up things related to incest.
Okay. And so, little brother, little sister type stuff could pop up in that search parameter, correct?
Yeah.
I have to say, Dave, you are so calm and measured in your interview with Lester. I know you. I feel like I can hear you seething, but it is remarkable composure.
Yeah, that's keeping the big picture in mind when you're interviewing these guys. It's a chess match. You hear Detective Don talk about the dance. I'm trying to get information from him that helps my case and buries him because I don't want this guy to ever breathe the same air as the rest of us free people. So I appreciate the compliment, but for me, it's remain calm, use your poker face, and get through it. Because the big picture is I want to beat this guy.
So he's offering this stuff up on his own. I suppose it's because he knows you're going to get into his computer anyway.
Yeah. So now, Dave, you're about to enter Lester's home with your search warrant. What's his home like?
An absolute shithole. This guy did not clean. He's got food out that's moldy, but he's got computers everywhere.
Like multiple computers?
Multiple computers and flash drives and... I ask this family member, do you guys have Wi-Fi here? Because I'm searching it on my phone to see what their network is. And she says, yeah. And he always names it something weird and creepy like want no hair, I like it bald.
Oh, God.
I mean, this guy's just nasty. He's creepy. So we grab his computers and flash drives and take it back to the police station and revisit with Lester. I ultimately charge him with 3 pretty significant counts of sex abuse, endangering the welfare of a minor because he's showing this pornographic material or exposing this child to sexual contact, and sodomy. And I know that's going to hold him. Those are big, big charges in our state. So I end up sending the computers off to our computer guy. It's the same guy that in the she said, he said.
Who said, I made your case.
Right. We love those forensic guys and gals.
They are essential to technology cases. They do a lot of good work for us. And certainly in this case, they did again. This computer forensic examiner gets through this computer and pulls all the different videos that had been searched that morning and the search terms that were populated into this YouTube search. So I get a host of videos that I get to look at. He gets into the computers and the flash drives, and we find all kinds of child porn, find all kinds of anime. We find all kinds of internet search history and browser history that is all packaged together. This guy's into child porn. And there's no doubt. So with the actual physical contact from this case that we get called out to, we also get a host of child pornography possession charges.
And that's a whole other separate, pretty severe charge if you're trading and searching for child porn in your state, yes?
They are. That's a big deal. I mean, if you have one picture, it's one thing. If you've got libraries, it's another thing. And those sentences add up pretty quickly after about 10 pictures. Then you're looking at decades.
But you personally still have to look through every single one, describe them, right? Or at a certain point, can you go, and there are 100 more videos?
Yeah, I'm pretty thorough on those because I want to show kind of the broad range of what this guy's into. But in this situation, it was pretty much all prepubescent. He was not like some of these other child pornographers where I deal with infants and toddlers. His strike zone's kind of the 6 to 12-year-old crowd. So that's what I'm dealing with. So I write a little synopsis of each file that I come across, and those eventually are images that he gets indicted on and what he'll have to go stand trial on.
So now he waits in jail for a trial or a plea deal.
Right. I've got him sitting in jail, and I listen to jail calls a lot. Dan knows how painful listening to jail calls are.
Painful because they're boring or?
They're boring. And the way people interact with their family, it's amazing how somebody in custody can blame everything on their family member who's out free and living their life and has nothing to do with why they're in jail.
They take no responsibility.
Exactly.
Why won't you put money on my phone? And I need money in my commissary. It's like, dude, you're the one that put yourself in there. I've had guys scream at their mother, at their father.
Wow.
Do this for me. You will do this for me.
Wow.
That's remarkable.
I sit there and I'm like pulling my hair out.
And did you find that to be true with Lester's jail calls?
So this guy's in jail for months. He didn't make one phone call.
Not one.
He's got no friends.
Really?
No family that'll accept a call from him. So.
Not even his parents.
Right.
Wow.
That makes this investigation easy because I don't even have to worry about it. Nobody wants to talk to Lester. This guy gets offered, I think the initial deal was in the neighborhood of 50 or 60 years. And he says, no, I'm not doing that. That's basically the rest of my life. I understand. Like I'd say, I'll take my chances with the jury. And then he gets offered 40 and he says, no, let's just take it to trial. So trial day comes and we're prepared. They're going to combine the child porn with the actual sexual acts. It's not a stretch for someone to say if they're interested in the child porn that them touching a kid isn't beyond the realm of possibility and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So all this stuff gets packaged together. He's going to be tried for all this stuff.
I've never heard anyone in law enforcement or the judicial system say that it's better to go to trial than take a deal. So Lester's strategy seems incredibly stupid.
Yeah, so I remember jury selection in this case. He's sitting closest to the jury box, and we've got tons of jurors that are coming through for voir dire, and at some point, they'll ask people, do you have a bias, or do you think you can be objective on this case? And one woman who's sitting literally feet from him in the jury box, she raises her hand, and she's shaking her head no, and the judge inquires, and she says, just I mean, look at him. He looks like a child molester. Look at him. And I'm kind of sitting there, you know, game face on. I'm not going to react, but my legs going under. I'm kicking the DA like, love her. Let's keep her.
I take it she didn't make it
to
the jury.
She didn't make it.
She did not make the jury.
When she says something like that, I'm so curious again about his demeanor. In that moment, does he like scoff? Does he laugh? Is he nothing face?
He's pretty stone faced. Yeah. He stayed in character. His defense attorney is competent, capable, and puts up a really good defense.
Really?
What's his defense?
What is the defense?
The defense is that maybe there wasn't contact, that it got interrupted before it actually happened. But the issue we have is we get the lab results back right before trial. So they had actually hired their own forensic analyst to go through our DNA collection and our procedures. And we get a DNA hit, male DNA, on the anal swabs. And it's one partial fraction of a DNA standard. So we get a little bit of DNA, and it's enough to say that it would match the suspect, Lester, or it would be seen within a frequency of one out of 3,960-something individuals in the U.S., like Caucasians, Caucasian population. That's not definitive by any means. We've had other hits where it's like, this would be seen in one out of every 10 billion people on the planet. So it's not a slam dunk, but she's only seen being anally sodomized by one person, and he happens to be the defendant. So we can whittle that down for the jury is there's only one person. It's consistent with the defendant, and there was no other adult males in the house.
To be really clear, the DNA that you got back is a fraction of DNA evidence, so you couldn't definitively match it with Lester's, but they could definitively say, oh, it belongs to this possibility of a group of people.
Correct. So we don't have 4,000 people on trial. We just got one, and his name's Lester, and his DNA matches a lot of the DNA that was pulled off this swab. So I'm feeling pretty confident. Plus, I've got this multiple-hour confession where there were times where it felt like kind of an over confession. He's given me too much and I'm going to have to corroborate those types of things. And there are other times where I think he's minimizing. So we kind of do this little wave of he's giving me info, then he's not, he's giving me way too much, I think.
What constitutes too much information?
It's kind of your read in the room on what this person's telling you and whether or not you think they might be embellishing.
Oh.
And he would say things like, this shouldn't reflect on Katie at all. This is my fault, but she probably won't tell you about this, but I did this. And so I'm thinking, well, she might not tell me about that. Why are you offering it up right now? You're struck by your conscience and you're just going to give that to me? Or are you embellishing a little bit, trying to say that you're a good guy and look, I'm being accountable right now? And you read through the transcript, he makes these answers that you're just like, what? What are you talking about?
Did you get the sense that maybe a part of him liked hearing himself say those things because they were at some point a part of his fantasy life?
I think there's a fantasy component to this guy. I mean, when I see writings on computers, you start thinking they're not solely a visual person, that also they want to think about it. So there's that fantasy component to it. And this guy is right in that strike zone.
Were they his writings or other people's?
Other people that he's just collected off the internet.
I see.
So tell us how the trial went.
So trial does not go well for him. They play the interview. There's portions of the interview where we do this dance about, do you want an attorney, do you not? That stuff gets cut out. So there's certain areas of the interview that are suppressed.
Why is that? Wouldn't it work to your advantage to ask him, you want a lawyer? No, I'm not lawyering up. And then they could see that he wasn't coerced in any way.
Well, for a jury, when people start requesting attorneys or say they want to remain silent, that can be prejudicial because some jurors might say, well, why aren't they cooperating with the police? Did he ask him a question he doesn't want to give him the answer to? So when we talk about attorneys or invocation of rights, if I'm on the stand and the defense attorney says, and then what did he say to you? He told me he wanted to remain silent. He wanted an attorney. I can't bring that up on the stand.
Oh.
It's prejudicial. So when somebody invokes their right to remain silent, you won't see that in a trial very often.
Because jurors might think, oh, he's guilty, so he's clamming up.
Right. Even though it's your right. you don't have to say a word to us.
And what's kind of funny is sometimes you'll get defense attorneys too, where they'll say, well, what happened after that? Well, that was the end of our contact. And then they will argue that the police didn't do a thorough job.
What?
I can understand. I mean, but people don't get the ins and outs of it all. I mean, I understand why somebody would leap to that conclusion.
Out of context, juries are going to say, yeah, that was really incomplete.
Why didn't they ask him all these other questions? Well, I couldn't.
Right. It's tricky.
So, you know, it started with this juror pointing out his obvious resemblance to a child molester. And this guy really does. You'd look at him and be like, would you ever let this guy babysit? No. No, I would not. So he gets tried and convicted. 36 years was the sentence. I won't have to worry about him in my career. He's gone.
Were the parents at the trial?
Parents were at the trial. We stand up for these people. I'm sure these parents feel horrible that they exposed their child to this, but I can honestly say other people from the outside would be like, how could you do this? These parents are in good faith leaving their children with somebody they don't think would ever do anything to their child. I can't imagine these parents were thinking, Lester's going to sexually abuse our child this morning. Let's take our chances and go on our vacation anyway. These are nice people.
Yeah, they aren't tweakers. They aren't frequent flyers for you guys at all. They're just lovely, normal people.
And it's not a calculated gamble. I didn't get the feeling from the parents that it was calculated at all. They left their child with someone they thought they could trust, and that person took advantage of it. You cannot understate the amount of work that sex offenders do on family and friends to convince them that they're not the wolf, that they're trustworthy, that they would never do anything. And if they got caught in the past, that they learned their lesson and they won't ever do it in the future. You can imagine a lot of families, parents, they have a lot of guilt. Like, I can't believe I bought this bullshit from this guy. But these guys are manipulative and they're really good at what they do.
So knowing that, what do you tell parents and families who think they'd be able to pick out the bad guys but may not have the whole picture? I mean, what can you do to further protect your children?
The biggest thing is to have a clear line of communication with your children that they can tell you anything, that they can trust that if they tell you something that they think they might get in trouble for, that they're not going to get in trouble, that it's okay to come to mom and dad with a secret, and that when an adult asks you to keep a secret, that we shouldn't be keeping secrets. There are no secrets in our family, that they're familiar with areas of their body that are off limits to other people, and that if they feel uncomfortable about a situation, whether or not it involves touching or it's just a certain situation where the kid is starting to feel scared or nervous, that they can remove themselves from that and feel comfortable that their parents are not going to put them back in that situation. When they go to Christmas and they've got the creepy uncle that always slaps them on the bottom or kisses them on the mouth and it makes them feel uncomfortable, that they don't have to just put up with that because that's Uncle Johnny,
right?
And that's how he acts. That no, my child's uncomfortable with that. They can feel comfortable telling me that they don't feel comfortable with that and that I'm not going to expose them to that. I don't expect them to put up with that.
And those are stereotypes that you're using, like creepy uncle, but I'm thinking that you're using those examples because those are true. Those stereotypes are true from what you've observed.
Absolutely.
Did Katie ever divulge more? Was she ever ready to say how often this had happened with Lester?
So she gave us a little bit. She talked about other times where there's this roughhousing, and yeah, he would put his hands on her and, you know, put his hands on her crotch.
So she confirms that because he brought that to you in the interview.
She confirms that, but she doesn't give me as much as he did.
Did she ever testify?
She did testify.
She did.
Yeah, and it's fairly brief. I mean, we play her interview. There's a video recorded interview with one of our forensic interviewers. I think in this case, it was Nicole, who does a lot of our interviews, and I've lauded her on this program before. She gets interviewed, doesn't give us a whole lot. She's still in that process of, I'm not ready to talk.
And the defense attorney in that situation, that's a big gamble for him. You know, there's cross-examination. Is he going to really go after a 9-year-old girl on the stand? What is the jury going to think when they see that?
Right. And he was fair to her and did not go after her. He went after some of us cops during the trial, and that's his job. I don't take that personally.
Some do.
Some do. Some cops take it very personal and they'll get defensive on the stand. It's a really bad look. This guy put up a good defense for his client. I didn't get the feeling ever once that he liked his client, but these guys have a right to a defense, and this attorney put up a good defense for him.
And what was the defense?
Maybe he didn't complete the act. We were reaching as far as saying that the actual sodomy occurred.
What a strange job.
Yeah.
On a case like this, how do you deal when you go home? What do you do?
I try to do my best to turn my brain off. I've got my trusty dog at home, and she has a great effect on me in that I can kind of focus on her. I don't have children, so I don't know what it's like to come home to your family like that, but certainly my dog is, you know, she diverts my attention away from what I've been dealing with all day. And then I imagine I sat down in front of the TV and turned on something, trying to make my brain turn off. But that was one of those days where being in the room with someone like that for hours and talking to them is troubling.
Yeah.
That's one of those where you realize you deal with monsters.
And what about after the conviction?
As far as the conviction, I just feel good.
Were you satisfied with 36 years?
36 years, a long, long time. I think that's the longest sentence I've ever gotten on somebody. I say I. It was the prosecutor and the victim.
Well, it's a team effort.
It's a team effort. And those are rewarding. And that's my closure, is that that chapter, that case closes.
Does anything ever surprise you anymore?
I don't know that I get surprised, but there's times where I just cannot believe what people can do to each other and how nasty or violent or disrespectful someone can be with somebody else, how you can violate someone like that. But it doesn't surprise me. It's just like, I got another one, and it's just another story where you can say, and this guy did it this way.
And just when you think you've seen it all in this job, it slaps you in the face and says, hold on, I got something for you.
The world is lucky to have you both.
Hear, hear.
Small Town Dicks is produced by Zibby Allen and Yardley Smith and co-produced by Detectives Dan and Dave.
This episode was edited by Soren Bation, Yardley Smith, and Zibby Allen.
Music for the show was composed by John Forrest. Our associate producer is Aaron Gaynor, and our books are cooked and cats wrangled by Ben Cornwell.
If you like what you hear and want to stay up to date with the show, head on over to smalltowndicks.com and become our pal on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Small Town Dicks. We love hearing from our small town fam, so hit us up.
Yeah, and also we have a YouTube channel where you can see trailers for past and forthcoming episodes. And we're part of Stitcher Premium now.
That's right. If you choose to subscribe, you'll be supporting our podcast. That way, we can keep going to small towns across the country and bringing you the finest in rare true crime cases, told, as always, by the detectives who investigated them. Thanks for listening, small town fam.
Nobody's better than you.